It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll find out why eating disorders have been on the rise during the pandemic. First, over the last two decades, the State of Working Wisconsin report has told the story of who's working, who's not, and what it's like to work in our state. The new report for 2021, out now, takes a look at job losses and gains, what the consequences of the loss of worker unions mean, the state of wages, and more, along with the impact of the pandemic on the working world. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What has your work experience been like in the last year, and what ways would you like to see Wisconsin jobs change? Do we need higher wages, more unions, more benefits? How has your job outlook changed over the last year and a half? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Laura Dresser is the Associate Director of COWS, a research center at UW-Madison that creates this annual report. She's a clinical assistant professor of social work and a labor economist. Laura, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, you do this report every year. The last couple of years, of course, not normal years. Laura, how has the pandemic changed the nature of this report and the working world that you're looking at?
I mean, I think last year, when the economy collapsed due to the shutdowns in April and lost more jobs than I'd ever seen an economy lose in a month, and work was fundamentally disrupted, we kind of changed. We moved to an online format. We talked to workers more. We thought that the wage data that was a year old might not feel very relevant. And I think we really felt like everything changed about work. So whether you were protected in your work and got to go home and do your work from home, or whether you were exposed in your work and working in entirely new ways with equipment to keep you safe, or whether you were losing your work. Last summer was, incredibly disruptive. I think this year we feel like we've kind of moved out and some things are more normal. We've gone back to some of those wage trends this year, and those are up on the website. But we're really also talking about how work has changed, because I know that it doesn't feel, I think, to the extent that things felt normal in February 2020, we don't feel like we're there now.
Are there things that you think the pandemic kind of didn't just change, but maybe highlighted about work in Wisconsin and the way it's been changing over the last 20 years or so?
Yeah. One of the big themes that we've always focused on in the State of Working Wisconsin has been the structure, the impossibility of the structure of low-wage jobs. And when I say impossibility, I mean that the wages are low, the hours are often volatile and inadequate, the benefits are very weak. And those workers, especially in food service and bars and entertainment industry, those workers who had the weakest jobs coming in, who we'd always been spotlighting as sort of the most vulnerable workers in our economy, were the ones who were pummeled by job losses, and so unemployment for many, and then exposure at work if for those who kept their jobs. And so it really exposed and exacerbated what we saw about the underlying problems of the lowest wage work in the Wisconsin economy.
Another main topic area I know you've followed over the years, Laura, is racial disparities in the workforce when it comes to employment numbers, when it comes to hourly wages and that sort of thing. What's the latest in Wisconsin? What do we know about how the pandemic affected that?
So we can't quite see the complete impact of the pandemic, of course, because the pandemic's not over, partly. And partly we only have wage data through 2020. So it only shows the very front of the impact of the pandemic. We do see, I think, and it is a result of organizing, increased attention to workers' power and voice, even coming into the pandemic, there was, and some very sustained economic growth, all of those things taken together, was beginning to lift wages at the bottom of the labor market. And that tends to close some of the really stark gaps that this economy generates. So we still have very significant racial disparity between white earners and Black and brown earners in this economy. But what we saw is the bottom of the labor market was lifting up a little bit, and that was closing some of those gaps. And I think we may continue to see that.
Talking to Laura Dresser from the research group COWS, looking at the annual report on the state of working Wisconsin, looking at employment numbers and trends, wages and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're an employer or employee, love to hear from you about what changes you've seen in the long run when it comes to working in Wisconsin or in this year and a half of pandemic. Call in at 800-642-1234. Has your line of work changed over the last year and a half? Have you sought a new career? Have you become unemployed because you're in one of those job areas that was hard hit? If you're an employer, have you had to change the way you hire people? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Laura, I know an ongoing thing you've been looking at in this series of reports over the years is union membership in Wisconsin. Tell us, I think people probably know generally the numbers have gone down over the years. Can you spell it out for us?
Yeah. You know, the story of union density in the nation, like unions have lost their share of representation in the workforce, even back to up to 1 in 3 workers back in the late 60s, early 70s were represented by unions, falling down to below 10%. But what happened, so that's kind of a picture that most people know, but and that's the federal context and the reason federal labor law matters. But in the state of Wisconsin, between Act 10, which in 2011 really reframed and completely diminished the powers and possibilities for public sector unions. And then in 2015, we passed Right to Work in the state, which really makes the terms of private sector unionization more difficult. And so what you can see across that decline is that from 2011 to current, Wisconsin has gone from above average unionization, above national rates, to well below national rates. You can see that our losses are in line with only Iowa, which has also generated enormous union losses. Whereas, you know, Illinois and Indiana, not they've lost, but not the ground that we've lost. And across the border in across the Mississippi in Minnesota, I was surprised to see that actually their share of workers in unions represented by unions has gone up over this period. I think that speaks to another kind of divergence that we've seen between these states.
And Laura, a lot of people just by the numbers aren't members of unions right now. A lot of them have never been a member of a union, so they might hear that statistic and say, so what?
Yeah, I think it's really important to see the ways that unions make a difference for all workers, not just for members. You know, the first thing that people know is that unions make a difference for members. Union workers earn more because collective voices can bargain over the value generated and get more for the workers. But the second way that unions matter is that as they get density in a specific sector, their ability to bargain up wages actually spills into other non-union properties. And that means that they're lifting wages of members and non-members alike, right? So unions have the potential when they have strong representation to kind of have this positive spillover on non-union workers. And then the third way is that unions have been an important voice politically for things that matter for working people, whether that's raising the minimum wage or extending the Affordable Care Act to more and more people, or just preserving the Affordable Care Act, which has faced such attack from conservatives. I think you can see unions are a force in all those ways for working people. And so to lose them is one of the reasons that we see it relates to all the inequality we see in this country.
We're talking to Laura Dresser, Associate Director of COWS, about their newly released report, The State of Working Wisconsin 2021. She's an Assistant Clinical Professor of Social Work at UW-Madison. You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. How has working Wisconsin changed for you? Have you lost a job over the last year and a half, say? Did you used to be in a unionized workplace? Now you're not. Do you want to see union numbers go up in the state, or are you okay with the trend of them going down? If you're an employer, what are you seeing as you try to hire people, or have you had to lay people off because the pandemic hit your workplace hard? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation now with Laura Dresser, Associate Director of COWS, a research center at UW-Madison, talking about their new report, The State of Working Wisconsin 2021. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is the state of working you in 2021? Has something big changed? Have there been small changes that you're happy to roll with, especially during the pandemic? Are you seeing opportunities for your wages to go up, whether in your current work or by changing it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to your calls now. Trish is with us in Madison. Trish, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Trish?
Well, I'm a pediatric RN, and I've had a time where I didn't work with a union and where I did work in a union. And the union, for me, actually made my work safer. At the time, we were required to float to different units, and I was floated to an ICU. And I had honestly no idea of what I was really doing. And it was very unsafe. And our union got that changed. So that was where I realized unions are super important. My brother-in-law, who works in HR, says, if you have good management, you don't need a union. And so doesn't that show you why we need unions? Because some of our managements don't support the people. The other comment related to COVID is that as a nurse, I just honestly felt we weren't protected enough with personal protective equipment. And I was within retirement. So I retired about 3 years earlier than I was planning on.
Trish, thanks a lot for sharing your work experiences there. Laura, what do you think, first of all, about Trish making the case that unions made the workplace conditions safer in that instance?
I mean, right. And I want you to notice that what she was talking about was safety for the patients. She wasn't even talking about the union protecting her in that instance. So we'll get to the PPE, but talking about how having a collective voice allows workers to see problems and to protect patients, right? And so often unions are making arguments, whether it's within education about public school funding and classroom size and things that are for issues beyond their own wages to make the work better. And I think that's a great example that that the caller brought up about how the union helped protect patients by helping workers say, you know, this isn't going to be safe for the people I'm working with. But also the point about union protection obviously this has been such an intense time for healthcare workers. And I'm so grateful for the caller and all the other people who are involved in healthcare. And the way that the pandemic just made that work so much more intense. There's some research that actually suggests that union workers were more protected because of the voice that worker had, deployment of personal protective equipment was better tended to be better in union hospitals and facilities. And there was less disease spread as a result. And I think that's another piece of evidence that just speaks to the caller's call.
Thanks for the call, Trish, at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Sue in Waukesha. Sue, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say also that not only do they protect the patients in the last caller's case, but unions also train their union employees, their unions themselves, and it's all paid through the benefit package that they get. So they're trained, they're safer, they're learning things that, and it's constant. It's a constant thing. Every year they have different training programs. New OSHA laws go into effect so that they have to make sure that their union employees are trained and kept up with that.
Sue, thanks a lot for the call. Laura, unions as providing workplace training, Sue says.
Yeah, it's important. It's a really important model, especially well established in the building trades where joint labor and management committees design and build the training, but also workers are really involved in the structure of and receiving training more in a lot of union shops and manufacturing and other places. Sometimes the there's training that happens in union and non-union shops alike, but there is a strong tradition of training that is related to and actually helps get to be better focused by the interests of workers and the identified needs that they can express through their unions. So that tends to matter a lot about making training work.
Thanks, Sue, for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Laura Dresser, Associate Director of the research group COWS, looking at their new report, The State of Working Wisconsin 2021. Laura, I've seen some people saying the balance of power recently may be shifting toward workers. A lot of talk about a labor shortage, employers having a hard time finding the workers that they want. Is that something, the data, I'm sure, is way too early to say definitively if that's happening, but are you seeing signs of that?
I mean, I think we can all see, when you go into your mailbox and you've got a couple of things randomly recruiting you for positions, or you see the sign in your neighborhood. I think it's clear, or, the bus drivers in Madison, school bus drivers, the call for school bus drivers, it's clear that in specific pockets, places where there were, workers had covered work, it's getting harder to find workers in some specific places. I think we know we're still kind of down in jobs, and so we want to keep an eye on that. I don't want to act like it's easy everywhere, that everybody or anybody can find a job at this point, or the job that really fits their needs. But I do think there's a lot of signs of some kind of power for workers, some ability for workers to really kind of demand better hours in some of these jobs that were often where workers were taking two or three to make a complete income or even to make an incomplete income. Now maybe they can turn that into one job. They can demand more from the wages and maybe also the benefits.
Should also ask about wage trends in Wisconsin. Another big part of the annual report you do at COWS. What have we seen when it comes to wages over time?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a 2-year lens and a 40-year lens. And this story, I mean, I think I'm going to start with the 40-year story because this seems an important story to me. Starting in 1979, wages were about $18 an hour for the median worker. We're up to just over $20 an hour now, if you adjust for inflation across that period. And that's, an increase of about, less than $3 an hour across a 40-year span. We know the economy is more productive. We know workers are more educated and more productive. And yet the payoff to that is just $3 an hour. And that's about inequality in our economy. And the way that returns to technology and labor returns in this economy have accrued to better off people. But then also one of the big good stories across that 40-year period is a decline, though the gender gap between women and men is still substantial. Women have come up across that period. Women's wages have come up and men's have fallen down a little bit. So just a tiny bit. And so there's a little bit more equity, a little bit less gap, I should say, between women and men's wages. But another thing that's opened up really significantly and distressingly over that 40-year period is Black men, Black women, Hispanic men, and Hispanic women really face substantial gaps. Even with the growth that a few of those groups have had and the declines that other groups have faced, there's just enormous racial and ethnic disparity in the state in wages.
Time for one more call. Russ is with us in Stoughton. Russ, hi.
Hi, I'm wondering if your guest is aware of the major breakthrough with the United Auto Workers at the Volvo plant in Virginia. They turned down two different recommended contracts by their union leaders and settled for a third one where new employees will be making the same wages as senior employees in 6 years. They had their health care benefits frozen for 6 years and stuff like that.
Russ, just a minute or so left. Laura, is that one you've been following? This is, I think, kind of breaking news over the last month or so.
Yeah, I haven't followed the Volvo. I really appreciate mentioning the UAW victory there. I have followed a little bit the Colectivo, the IBEW organized Colectivo workers in this state. And I think that, and, you know, different places across the state have been organized over the last year in spite of these very hard rules on organizing nationally and in the state. And so I do think the latest polling suggests that the support for unions is as high in this nation as it has ever been. 68 or more percent, you know, support unions say they would join them. And that I think we're starting to see some of the impact of that in events like the Volvo case that your worker just, I mean, that your caller just called about. I don't know that one very well, though.
Russ, thanks for the call. Laura, just in our last half a minute, what are you watching for next? A lot of uncertainties out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think Delta isn't the last variant, right? It's just the best right now. And so I think the trajectory of the disease really matters a lot. But I think also this kind of question of what work really should be. If the 25-year story of the state of working Wisconsin is that the structure of low-wage jobs has been unsustainable, I sort of hope that the next chapter that we all write together is that these lower-wage jobs move much closer to our median wages, that they begin to deliver real benefits, or we deliver public benefits like health insurance through other means, and that we that workers really can afford to have life in these jobs rather than just scrambling to get by. That's the what I hope we get to see, and I guess we'll wait.
Laura, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
Laura Dresser is the Associate Director of COWS, a research center at UW-Madison, and a Clinical Assistant Professor of Social Work. You can find a link to the new COWS report called The State of Working Wisconsin 2021 at WPR.org/Central Time. There are some signs that eating disorders have increased during the pandemic. The National Eating Disorders Association reported an increase in calls to its helpline by as much as 80% at several points during the pandemic. Other research found that people already diagnosed with anorexia and binge eating disorders had worse symptoms. A quick content advisory here. We will have some discussion of eating disorder symptoms in this conversation. We're talking about this increase in eating disordered behavior during the pandemic, looking at risk factors and how to help yourself or a loved one. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or a loved one recovered from an eating disorder? What do you want people to know about recovery? Did you suffer from more symptoms during the pandemic? Do you have a question about eating disorders? Do you think there are things people get wrong about them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Brenda Velaceris is the executive director and founder of Evolve Healing. Brenda, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Now, you and your colleagues work with people with eating disorders, I understand. Have you seen changes either in the intensity of eating disorders or the demand for help with them over this last year and a half or so?
Yes, we have. We have a great influx of calls, whether it's just inquiry calls, like how to support a loved one or how to get help for myself, you know, for themselves, all the way to just seeking out treatment. We have wait lists for all levels of care. And in talking with other eating disorder clinics throughout the United States, they also are in the same, experiencing the same high call volume, high demand for treatment.
And at the same time, and you're based here in Wisconsin, Brenda, a lot of different kinds of treatment for a lot of conditions, the pandemic has gotten in the way of it. It was harder to have, for example, in-person sessions. Has that been a roadblock here?
Initially, it was. It created or it put us in a position to be really creative with our resources, and it ended up turning out to be a really unique experience. So we went virtual for our treatment, whether that was for outpatient or for more of our intensive programs, such as IOP, which is a 3-hour a day program, or PHP, which is a 6-hour a day program. And we did all of it virtual for quite a long time. It, of course, doesn't replace that in-person interaction, but we were able to provide those services and care to individuals quite successfully.
I'm hoping we can get to some misconceptions about eating disorders. And one is one that I got to say, I share deep down, I think, and even though I know it's wrong, in pop culture, I think there's an image of an eating disorder sufferer as being young, white, thin, and female. And looking into this, it affects a lot more people than just that, right?
Absolutely. It really, eating disorders do not discriminate. It has, it's deeply rooted in genetics, as well as social factors, cultural factors, psychological factors, and none of that discriminates. So it can be male or female, it can be adolescent all the way into geriatric population. We had a patient that was 78 years old that we were treating for anorexia, and our youngest patient that we've had was 9. It encompasses all different types of individuals.
In our society, of course, we talk a lot about the food we eat, about weight gain and weight loss, and as I understand it, not always in healthy ways. And during the pandemic, there were a lot, I think, of maybe well-meaning news articles saying, hey, don't gain that quarantine 15, mm-hmm. don't put on weight because you're stuck at home and eating different foods. Can those messages be harmful when it comes to eating disorders?
Yes. Yeah, it can. I think that contributed to the influx in calls and onset of eating disorders for some people. How eating disorders work is we're genetically predisposed to an eating disorder. Certain people are genetically predisposed to an eating disorder, and that lays dormant until a significant life event presents itself. Without the pandemic, that could be like starting high school, graduating from college, getting married, parents getting divorced, some sort of trauma event. And then that sets things in motion for an eating disorder. Well, the pandemic created this great panic. And people that thought that they could manage their anxiety or could control things outside of themselves were faced head on with that isn't true. And so that kind of set that predisposition for an eating disorder into motion, along with the societal pressures of looking a certain way, being a certain way, fitting into a certain group or a certain expectation, created this perfect storm for people to overexercise, to do these different kinds of diets, to overly restrict and control what they're inputting in their body, to create different kinds of panics over certain foods, like if I eat sugar, I'm going to die, kind of a thing. It played a huge role in this.
We're talking to Brenda Velasaris, executive director and founder of Evolve Healing, looking at eating disorders, higher numbers by some measures anyway during the pandemic, more concern about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question about eating disorders and experience, if you're willing to share that, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Brenda, how can a person spot the signs of an eating disorder in their own life? I assume it may sneak up on people. They don't realize that there's a problem.
I would say most people are probably not going to notice. Mm-hmm. It's their friends and family, people around them, that are going to start pointing it out by making subtle comments like, you never go out anymore, or you're always so worried about how you're looking, or I haven't talked to you in 3 weeks. What's going on? So you're going to start noticing things that are out of the ordinary for you, a bit more obsessive, a bit more worrisome about certain things such as body or what you're eating, a bit more withdrawn, a bit more controlling over things. Those usually are like the early signs. Weight loss does not necessarily equate an eating disorder. Somebody can have anorexia and not be like have dramatic weight loss or be within the normal BMI. It's more like, are they having erratic vital signs or poor lab draws? Are they starting to show signs of malnourishment? Those are more of the indicators of an eating disorder, but they tend to be a little bit more subtle. And so the behavioral aspects of an eating disorder are going to show first.
And Brenda, you just mentioned anorexia. Can you lay out that and a couple of the other most common types of eating disorders and briefly what each of them consists of?
Sure. Probably more of the well-known eating disorders are bulimia and then anorexia. And anorexia is really about restriction. Restriction of caloric energy and a really high preference for body image, looking a certain way, weighing a certain weight, etc. Bulimia is more of eating and then purging. Purging can be in many different facets. That could be through laxative or diet pills. That could be through over-exercising. That could be through vomiting, so any compensatory behavior. There's binge eating disorder, which is new to the DSM-5 within like the last 2 or 3 years. And that's where you eat large amounts, large quantities of food, high caloric foods in a very short period of time with a significant amount of guilt and remorse, but the inability to stop yourself with no compensatory behaviors at all. And then there's some atypical eating disorders such as RFED, which is usually termed as picky eating. We'll only eat certain foods or certain textures, stay away from things that smell a certain way, and it becomes very restrictive and can lead to malnourishment. And then there's like orthorexia. And orthorexia is, I want to be really, really healthy and have extremely clean eating, but it went to the dark side. And so now they're becoming extremely malnourished, underweight. They have a very limited lifestyle because they won't go out. They won't allow anybody to cook their food anymore for them. And so it gets kind of haywire.
We're talking to Brenda Velasaris, executive director and founder of Evolve Healing. She's talking to us about an increase in eating disorders during the pandemic. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about eating disorders, signs and symptoms, risk factors, how to get help? Do you have resources you'd like to share with those struggling with an eating disorder or an experience you'd like to share and maybe, hopefully, a treatment that helped you out? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Brenda Velasaris, executive director and founder of Evolve Healing. She's telling us about eating disorders because more people reported eating disorder symptoms during the pandemic since it began. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about eating disorders and experience you can share with us? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Brenda, I wanted to ask you about treatment. You just said there are definitely different kinds of eating disorders, but what are some of the basics that people can do to get treatment and hopefully overcome this kind of disorder?
I think the most common treatment is outpatient, which is a routine appointment with a therapist once or twice a week, seeing a dietitian once a week. Sometimes it can be every other week, and then maintenance would be considered monthly. Somebody is pretty much near completion of recovery from an eating disorder or just need a tune-up would be monthly sessions. And then there's higher levels of care that we offer more intensive treatment. IOP or intensive outpatient is 3 hours a day, 3 to 4 days a week. It's typically Monday through Thursday. And then there is partial hospitalization. That would be the next level. That's typically 6 hours a day, Monday through Friday. And then there's residential, which is 24-hour care. And people are usually in residential 30 to 45 days. And then there's inpatient. Inpatient is the most intensive level of treatment. It's also the shortest amount of treatment because you're really just in a medical hospital to get medically stable. It can be anywhere from 1 to 2 days to, you know, several weeks, depending on how stable you are. But the minute that you're stabilized, then you would bounce back to residential. So you can go through these different levels of care, up or down, if you can think of it as a ladder, depending on what your symptomology is and what kinds of treatment needs you require.
We heard from Chris in Milwaukee, who says she had an eating disorder and says it was hard to get a doctor to pay attention when your eating disorder results in a loss of weight. Chris says doctors seem to be more than happy to talk about obesity or being overweight. What would you say to health care providers to take a situation like Chris's seriously?
Chris's experience is actually very, very common. Earlier today, I had a conversation with a client that was a 16-year-old that was getting praised by their doctor for losing weight, and they have anorexia. And the client at 16 was kind of like, I don't think that's the right thing, the right message I should be getting. and so this caller's experience is actually correct. Like, there's a lot more focus on obesity and having a low BMI and being thin because it's going to lead to all these health concerns. And so there's a lot more encouragement to lose weight or to be put on a diet or take a medication than to look at like natural growth curves and what's appropriate to the client. So appropriate screening, there's a SCOFF screen. It's 4 questions that medical personnel can quickly use to check to see if there is the potential for an eating disorder, and it can be easily caught. I like to provide a lot of education to medical staff so that they can look for warning signs and kind of lay off the, you know, that the weight is the end all be all for health, and that the way you look determines how healthy you are, and always to keep in the back of their mind that you could potentially be working with somebody that it has an eating disorder or had an eating disorder.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Angela is with us in Baraboo. Angela, hi.
Hey.
What did you want to bring up, Angela?
So I just wanted to bring up the fact that, I have had an eating disorder. And I think the one thing that we should look at is that we are all beautiful and that you should just feel healthy. Mm-hmm. And women are some of the strongest people in the world. We give birth. We make other human beings in our bodies. And to do that, we have to be healthy and we have to eat right. And I just want to let you know that, you know, whether it's a media thing, which I think has greatly contributed to eating disorders, or whether it's I have a crush on this guy or anything, men love us, and we just need to learn to love ourselves as much as men love us.
Angela, thanks a lot for the call. I want to bring Brenda into this. Angela, concerned about our body self-image, especially for women. Brenda, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that's those societal pressures in our culture that puts a lot of pressure on us to look a certain way and be a certain way and to fit a mold or an expectation that the majority of us cannot fit in. We're just not genetically predisposed to, you know, weigh a certain weight or, you know, be a certain figure. And what the caller was saying is, you have to kind of build up from within and recognize your own strengths. And I always tell my clients to bubble wrap yourself against some of those messages that is out there in our culture and in our society so that you can take care of yourself the way that you need to be taking care of yourself and not try to be somebody you're not.
Angela, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Tom next in Milwaukee. Tom, hello.
Hi. I'm wondering, is there a relationship between eating disorders and obsessive compulsive disorders?
Oh, interesting question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that you're actually onto something. There is comorbidity when it comes to an eating disorder. Very rare does an eating disorder present by itself. It usually is in conjunction with another mental illness, whether that be depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, or obsessive compulsive disorder. We do see obsessive compulsive disorder or OCD very commonly show up with more of those restrictive eating disorders like orthorexia or anorexia. Now, it's kind of a chicken or an egg type situation. Did the eating disorder create some of these OCD tendencies, or was there already a predisposition for OCD and then it morphed into eating disorder diagnosis? That's hard to sift out, but do they present themselves together? Absolutely.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking about eating disorders, they seem to have gone up on the rise during the pandemic. Brenda Velasquez is with us, executive director and founder of Evolve Healing, which works with people with eating disorders. Brenda, what would you like to see from the media when it comes to these issues of body image that one of our earlier callers brought up? You know, I do a lot of our grocery shopping over the years. I've seen the tabloids at the checkout line, half the articles for a while were about, hey, this celebrity's gained weight. And about a quarter of them seemed to be, oh no, this celebrity's too thin, they're anorexic. What would you like to see from the media?
Well, I mean, in some ways, some of that is changing. There are a lot of influencers out in social media now pushing back. There's more diversity being presented in ad campaigns, like Old Navy is now, you know, being more size inclusive in their stores instead of having to order particular sizes online only. The models that are in these ads are more diverse in their size and their shape and in their color. And I think that's all very helpful. But media is going to sell what the consumer wants. And so as long as the consumer is desiring these kinds of things, it's going to continue to be presented out in society. So I think it has to start within. And then the less we care about that stuff, then the less we're going to see it.
And just our last minute, Brenda, you mentioned that family members and loved ones are often the first ones to spot the warning signs. If we think someone we know might have an eating disorder, what is the right way to bring that up? It's a tough conversation to have.
Oh, it is very tough. I think you have to have the conversation. I think so many families want to dance around it, pretend that it's not there, that they'll grow out of it, it'll go away. And really, you just have to kind of put it out on the table and just say, I'm concerned. You're acting a little bit out of the ordinary for yourself. I'm noticing X, Y, and Z, maybe use an example. But when you present this to your loved one, do so in a very loving way, not in a shame way, not in an intimidation way, not out of fear or panic that you're experiencing, because the more fearful you are, the more panic you are, the worse the conversation's going to go. If you don't feel like you're equipped to bring up this information to your loved one, go see a counselor that specializes in eating disorders so they can prep you on how to present it. They can give you some tips and tricks and get you all set up to have that conversation with your loved ones so that they can get help.
Brenda, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, this was so much fun. Thanks for having me.
Brenda Velasquez is the executive director and founder of Evolve Healing. She joined us today for a look at eating disorders during the pandemic. Groups that deal with eating disorders report more calls to their helplines, big jumps in calls at some points over the course of the pandemic. By the way, if you or someone you love is struggling with an eating disorder, you can call one of those helplines. It's the National Eating Disorders Association helpline. The number is 800-931-2237. Again, that's 800-931-2237.